Okay, it's a couple of minutes after 12. Let's see if we have Derek on the line. Derek, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
Terrific. Wonderful. That was the most anxious moment of my my show here today, was doing this telephone thing right. Welcome to Occidental California and Greater Sonoma County.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
By way of introduction, I read a small blurb off of Thought to Exist in the Wild earlier. I'll just quickly read it again for the sake of formality. Derek, called the philosopher poet of the ecological movement, Derek Jensen is an activist, teacher, and author of more than 10 books now. Publishers Weekly described Jensen's work as, quote, breaking and mending the reader's heart. I just want to expand on that for a minute, and then we'll begin our conversation. I met Derek in 2002. I had been at the Bioneers Conference, and I saw some flyers announcing his appearance at a Berkeley bookstore, and I went with my sweetheart, and we went to the bookstore, and local group Rebecca Riots played a few songs, and then Derek took over for the evening. And he spoke to us and with us, and at the end of the evening, I went up and bought three of his books. I had never heard of Derek other than, I should say, I had heard of Derek through his interviews in the Sun magazine, which were uniformly superb. So I recognized the name, so we went to hear him speak, and I bought his books. And the books were Listening to the Land, A Language Older Than Words, and The Culture of Make-Believe. And I took the books home, and I read them, and I had, like many, many thousands of others, had pretty much a life-changing encounter with Derek's work. Those of you who know him don't really need to say very much more. Those of you who are not yet familiar with his work, there's libraries and there's bookstores, and I consider his work essential for our passage into a successful human future. This is an encounter with our history. It's a look into the mirror. It's not easy, but it's absolutely, it's a necessary confrontation, and it calls us to a necessary accounting, and it calls us to our honesty, and it calls us to our hearts and souls. So, thank you for coming on, Derek, and I guess we'll just get started unless you would like to make any sort of introductory remarks.
Oh, just thank you for that very gracious and eloquent introduction.
Well, takes one to know one. Eloquent is one of the adjectives I use when I describe your writing to other people. Aside from the content of your writing, I want to compliment you on what a wonderful writer you are.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. Thanks.
Who are we, Derek? Who are the humans?
Well, I think, honestly, I think at this point humans are becoming fewer and far between. And maybe 6 months ago, I live next to a pond, and actually right now I'm sitting next to the pond and looking at it, and in a lot of my writing, in a lot of my books, I've written about how I'm afraid every year that this will be the year that the worldwide amphibian die-off comes home. And actually, the last 2 years have been the years that that's happened. That the pond, up until 2 years ago, all spring would be you couldn't have a human conversation outside at night because it was so loud with frogs. And these last 2 years has been maybe you can hear five or six frogs at a time, and they're being killed off by, in this case, by this mold called Saprolegnia. It's killing the eggs. And so this year I brought in a bunch of eggs and hatched them inside and let them back out when they were little tadpoles. And, you know, it doesn't do much, but it's something. Anyway, the point is that one night this spring, I'm writing a book right now, a bunch of books, and one of the books I'm working on is a book about our relationship between dreaming and waking realities, and about, you know, who is the muse and where do dreams come from, and all that. We can talk about that or not, as the case as the case may be. But the point is that I asked dreams for asked frogs for a dream about what is it like to be you, and that night I had this dream of, it was one of the worst dreams of my life, of just being tormented by all these flesh-eating zombies. And I woke up thinking that, I mean, okay, so let's step back for a second. And, you know, this culture is killing the planet. And we all know this. And we know that, you know, 90% of large fish in the oceans are gone, and that topsoil is disappearing, and that there's docks in every mother's breast milk, and the salmon are going, and, I mean, the migratory songbirds are going, bats are going, and the response by this culture is drill, baby, drill. And if I were, you know, some sort of space alien looking down at what this culture is doing, I would think that these people are doing everything they can to make this crash as bad as possible. I mean, it doesn't take a cognitive giant to figure out that if you have a way of life that's based on non-renewable resources, it won't last. In order to take a cognitive time. I mean, think about this for a second. That if you ask any reasonably intelligent 6 or 7 year old, how do you stop global warming that's caused in great measure by the burning of oil and gas, they'd give you an answer. That would not involve cap and trade. They'd say, stop burning oil and gas. And yet, that's not what's happening. You know, the Arctic is melting, and what happens is members of this culture get all excited about the Northwest Passage and about this grand opening for more resources they can extract up there. And it's absolutely stunning. And then on the other hand, I also want to say that where I live right now, I am on Talawa land. The Talawa Indians lived here for 12,500 years, if you believe the myths of science, if you believe the myths of Talawa, the lived just since the beginning of time. And 12,500 years is long enough to, we can call that sustainable. And when the dominant culture arrived here 180 years ago, the rivers were so full of salmon that you couldn't see the bottom. You could hear the runs of salmon for miles before you'd see them. You could, people were afraid to put their boats in water for fear they'd capsize. And the place was a paradise. And in 180 years, it's been absolutely trashed. And we can, you know, in my different books, I've talked about how in a language of words, I talked about how this culture is irredeemable psychologically. In a culture make-believe, I talked about how it's irredeemable socially. The social rewards, the society rewards competition, acquisition, as opposed to what benefits communities of the land base. And, because, you know, the Indians walking around here, the Talawa, they weren't just sort of living some romantic life of, you know, occasionally picking a berry or something. They were living conscious ways of living with agreements with other peoples. And it's like Ray Rafael says about, you know, Indians influence the landscape too, but they did so with the recognition they're still going to be living there in 500 years. And that's really the question is, what do you want the land to look like in 500 years? And if you want the, you know, if you're planning on living in place for the next 500 years, you're going to treat it differently than you are if you're, you know, planning on going into outer space, or if you're planning on, you know, if you don't care. And anyway, so in culture make-believe, I talked about how socially the social reward systems make this culture irredeemable. And then in Endgame, it was about how you can't have, if your way of life requires the importation of resources, it will never be sustainable. And in What We Leave Behind, it was, if your waste products aren't good for the land base, then, you know, if you don't leave the land in better condition than when you were born, then you would have been better off not being born. The world would be better off not with you not having been born, and there's no, and your culture cannot be sustainable because you have to help the land base. That's how you have a sustainable culture, is by making it so the land base is healthy. And the reason, and then that all comes to the book I'm working on right now, one of the books I'm working on right now, is how the culture is really spiritually irredeemable. So back to the question of who are we? There's who do we think we are versus who we are.
Right.
And who we really are as human beings is, we are human animals who live in community and who evolved to live in communities of 150 to 200 people and or less, and who need habitat, and who we think we are, and who I am is that intersection of, and that intermingling of me with the air I'm breathing, and with the frogs, and with the trees. And this is not some sort of, you know, woo-woo cosmic thing. It's that we are the relationships we share, whether we believe that or not. And, you know, if my mother were to die, I would feel tremendous pain. And that's, you know, she's a part of me just as much as I would feel tremendous pain if I lost a finger. And so, you know, who we are our relationships, but who we think we are is an ego in a sack of skin. Who we think we are is a machine guided by selfish genes. Who we think we are is this machine compelled to exploit. It's like I can't watch nature programs anymore because they make me so mad because they project all of this capitalism, the notion of exploiting, onto the natural world. You know, we're always taught that natural selection works through who's the best who can exploit, who can, you know, exploit resources the best. And I can show that's not true in one sentence with a couple semicolons. And that's those creatures who survived in the long run have survived in the long run. And you don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings. You survive in the long run by actually making your habitat better. That's how the world got to be so wonderful and beautiful in the first place, is by everybody leaving the world better than it was before they were there.
Right.
That's what salmon do. They make forests better by their presence. And so who are we? We are, you know, I like what R.D. Lang said about the brainwashing that this culture does to children, that you know, every child is a new chance for redemption. But we shall soon turn them into imbeciles like ourselves with high IQs if possible.
He called kindergarten the pathetic surrender of babies.
And it's really true. I mean, that's one of the functions of school, is to teach us how to conform, to teach us to count the moments. I mean, that's one of the real purposes of school, is to teach us to count the moments and to wish our lives away.
The first game we played was musical chairs, which I call Bump Little Susie Around the Corner. There's one winner.
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because just yesterday, and I don't often think about seventh grade, but I was thinking about...
It's merciful.
Yeah. I was thinking about when I was a kid, you know, we always hear about how cruel kids are and how they tease so many people, and I saw that, but I never participated in it. I didn't see it as much as you see it in movies. I did see it some, a fair amount, but it wasn't as overriding as I've seen it. Except I remember in seventh grade, for one year I went to a church school instead of public school. And I remember one of the things that the teacher we had in seventh grade, one of the games we would play, which is just appalling in retrospect, is this game where one person would sing, "Hey lolly lolly lolly," and then everybody else would sing it, and they'd say "hello lolly lolly," everybody would sing that, and then they would make up a derogatory rhyme about someone else in the class. And one I remember was, "I know a girl whose name is Kraft," that was her last name, "when she opens her mouth it creates a draft," and it was all insulting. And this was I mean, this was in addition. I mean, I don't want to get too much into this, because that was just a really horrible thing for a teacher to do, as opposed to the more systematic surrendering of our will to teachers. But, you know, I think back on that, I'm just appalled that a teacher would actually foment that sort of insulting of others, of the students, with students by other students.
The template being competition for resources.
Yeah, yeah. And putting somebody else down, making yourself over the other person.
Mm-hmm. All against all.
Yeah.
So we're dealing with a pathology, an egregious pathology, an intractable, seemingly intractable pathology in our human consciousness and behavior. Yes?
Oh, absolutely. And I've long since given up on any notion, long since given up on any notion of a voluntary transformation. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, it seems that behavior is in a closed loop or a closed dyad with identity, that that somehow we infer our identity by observing our behavior. In other words, we witness constantly all this grotesque, perverted, desecratory behavior, and we...
Which is socially rewarded.
Well, the social organization selects for this behavior. These behaviors, I mean, we're constantly told that we're greedy. And it's not that we're greedy so much, but that our social organization selects for greed. Like, it's another way of saying it's socially rewarded. So behavior, we observe our behavior and we infer our identity. Well, this is who we are. We're these, disturbed animals.
Well, Ruth Benedict did this exploration of why the anthropologist, of why some cultures are good, to use her word, and some cultures are not good. Why are some cultures, they treat women well, treat children well, they're not very warlike, people are happy, and other cultures, there can be these people are unhappy, there's a lot of competition, a lot of war, and the valorization of war, valorization of competition, and she's trying to figure out why the difference. You know, was it wealth, poverty, was it race, was it matrifocal cultures? And what she found out is that there was really one pretty simple rule, and that's, you know, the question, are humans selfish, are humans communal creatures? And the answer is both. And the way that those cultures who were able to be good cultures, the way they're able to do so is by recognizing that we are both, and so by praising, making it so we're selfish for praise. Mm. And so those who are praised the most are those who help the community the most, as opposed to those who acquire the most.
Right.
And it all comes down, she said, to how culture handles wealth. That if it handles it through what she called a siphon system, whereby wealth is constantly siphoned from rich to poor, and it's done through social rewards, I'll talk about that in a second, then everybody in the culture is going to be secure. And if, on the other hand, wealth is handled through what she called a funnel system, where wealth is constantly funneled from poor to rich, then everybody is insecure. And just a really clear and quick example is if I go out, you know, hunting or fishing or gathering today, and I catch a whole bunch of salmon to bring back, if I keep them all, then within a functioning, healthy functioning, good community, I would be shunned for that. Or I might have the hell beaten out of me for that. That would be unacceptable behavior. As opposed to if I go fishing or hunting or gathering and then I come back and then I distribute all that food to everybody in the group, then everybody says, oh my gosh, Derek, you're so great, you're so wonderful. I get praised for behavior that benefits the group as a whole. Whereas if I act acquisitively, and this is how it works in a healthy functioning family too. I mean, you know, you all sit down to dinner, and if somebody says, you know, Junior, could you please pass the potatoes? Then Junior, you know, says, no, you're going to have to pay me for them. You know, Junior's not going to last very long at the table. But on the larger scale,
I give you such a smack.
Well, within many cultures, I mean, we talk about how the, you know, Lakota had this special, sacred, wonderful relationship with the buffalo or the bison, and obviously they did. But on another level, they also had rules that if you killed bison out of season, they would beat the hell out of you and break all your weapons and
right.
burn your teepee and reduce you to beggary.
Right, right.
And,
I have to interrupt you here. I have to change the tapes.
Okay.
Can you hang on for a few minutes?
Sure.
I'm going to play a song, and we'll be right back.
Okay.
Do you ever look upon her face with upturned eyes? Tick a stick, across the picket fence posts of your mind and wondered all the time when love was blind and you were full of wonder.
Okay, we have Derek Jensen on the phone. Derek, are you still with us?
Yep.
All right, well, where do we leave off? Do you remember? I got you in the middle of a sentence. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Ruth Benedict, rewarding behavior. Basically that, I mean, it's pretty straightforward, that whatever behavior your community, that's another thing I was going to mention. Well, we'll drop that. It's that the, basically what your society rewards is what you're going to get. And if you have, and we see this on every level. A few years ago, I read The Politics of Heroin by Alfred McCoy, which is a really, really good book. And he talks about the relationship between the CIA and heroin trafficking all over the world. And sometimes the CIA has participated actively, but a lot of times all it is they create enforcement-free zones where if there is someone who is working for the CIA, the CIA turns a blind eye to their opium production. And so what ends up happening is that because this particular behavior is not disallowed, but is instead rewarded by money, then of course what happens is those people become immensely rich. And a lot of it has to do with what does your culture allow? What does your culture not allow? I mean, this culture obviously allows rape, 25% of all women in this culture are raped in their lifetime, another 19% fend off rape attempts. And the average, only 6% of men who commit rape ever even spend one night in jail. And this culture obviously accepts ecocide. We can start laying out some of the what this culture does and does not promote very quickly, and we can soon begin to see that what this culture promotes is exactly the sort of community-destroying behavior that should be disallowed. I'm talking about the acquisition of money. I mean, it's very simple. I mean, if I say Bill Gates, we all know that I'm talking about this immensely rich person. And the fact that we know and that Bill Gates is given admiration and really all he has done is accumulate vast amounts of money, that's the problem right there. That accumulation should be disallowed at the very least.
Right, well, that's where we come in.
Yeah, and I want to say one more thing. This is the thing I was going to say earlier about Garrett Hardin's Tragedy of the Commons. It's always really pissed me off because his idea of the Tragedy of the Commons is you basically have to have private property, because if you have a commons, then what's going to happen is everybody's going to try to take a little bit more and a little bit more until the commons falls apart, like the famine or whatever. Or, that would be something that your entire community, that would be part of your communal, I don't know the right word, inheritance is all I can think of, and that's not the right word, but that's part of your community. And the point is that whole Tragedy of the Commons is absolutely false, because that's the tragedy of the failure of the commons. Because what happens if you have a real commons is, say you have, 15 communities around a central sheep grazing area. And what happens is if somebody grazes too many sheep and starts to damage it, everybody goes over and talks to that person and says, hey, you can't do that. Because that's what you do, is you all take care of the commons.
Right.
And so that, the Tragedy of the Commons has been a horrible bit of propaganda that doesn't even make any sense and is absolutely inaccurate to how commons work, and it wouldn't have been promoted at all if it wouldn't have supported the ends of capital.
Right. It comes back to responsibility, to individual responsibility, and this is what this crisis is all about. It's about calling us to our human maturity and our responsibility, take responsibility for ourselves.
Well, two things. One is that I love the etymology of the word responsibility. It comes from respondere, which means to give and return. And so what responsibility really means is that I need to give, the land gives me life, and I need to give something back. I am responsible to the salmon. And what that means is they give me food, and then I give them back, and they also give the forest food, and then what do I give back to them? I need to be responsible to them.
Right.
And another part is that there's personal responsibility, which is very important. But what's even more important here is that is to hold others responsible too.
Yeah.
Because as you read in the, you know, shorter showers thing that you read before I came on, that's the one you read, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the dead ends that the environmental movement has gotten into, is this notion that personal accountability or personal responsibility is all there is. But no, we have to hold others responsible too.
Right.
That's a lot of it. And I just had a little bit of a fight with somebody a few days ago. Somebody wrote to me and said that she thought it was absolutely unfair that I want to change other people's lifestyle without their permission,
yeah,
by force if necessary,
mm,
and that's arrogant and, you know, essentially fascist. And I wrote back and said, so are you saying that we shouldn't stop Ted Bundy? That, you know, Ted Bundy's lifestyle involved, you know, hitting women on the head and, you know, killing them, kidnapping, killing them, raping them. So does that mean, since that's part of his lifestyle, that we don't need to, that our responsibility as members of a community is not to stop him? He said, no, I see that, but that's different. And it's like, well, no, because 120 species went extinct yesterday, and those are my family members.
Right.
And, you know, it's not enough to just, you know, attempt to be somehow personally pure in a, in this larger death camp culture.
Right.
We also need to stop, you know, stop the destruction of our communities. And that is part of what responsibility is not simply being, you know, doing what you can to personally minimize your contact with this culture, to navigate those systems of oppression, but instead it's to bring down those systems of oppression.
Right. I think of it in terms of dissolving this culture in solution.
Yeah, that's good.
We have a dual identity. We have an individual identity, but we also have a species identity, and the individual identity is utterly dependent on the species identity. We need everyone to be well. We need everyone to be fed and housed and have sanitation and clean water and, like that. We are each other. And our individual identities are something that we've been indulging in. They have their value, and they're not to be thrown out. They're to be honored for what they are. But we've neglected our species identity. We've neglected our family responsibilities.
And I would say our communal identity too, which includes not just humans.
Yeah, absolutely. This is our family also. We're human earthlings.
Right.
And we've arrived so far in 2009. We've all come from thousands or tens of thousands of different cultures and heritages and identities. And for thousands of years, our primary identities have been racial and religious and national and tribal. And suddenly, we're at this dead end in our history, or in this form of life, in this form of social organization. And all our, what we've always known as primary identities suddenly are revealed as simply modifiers. They're transformed from nouns to adjectives. We're no longer, we all have stories of how we got here, what peoples we came through, what worlds we come from. But now we're all here together, unmistakably, and our irreducible identity is human being, and even that is a modification of earthling. It's a subset of earthling. So these are our primary identities now.
Well, I don't think those identities are sustainable.
You mean the lesser identities?
No, the human identity.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Tell me more.
Because I don't think it's possible to have large-scale social organizations and large-scale technological organizations that are sustainable. And I think part of the problem is this identification with a larger, with a social system that is not human scale, that is not family slash clan slash slightly larger. And I don't think, see, that's part of it, is once you lose that face-to-face accountability, it becomes much easier for all sorts of bad behavior to be perpetrated, because if you're living in a small community, say there's 100 of you in a community who are living in place over a long time, well, it's like Jeanette Armstrong said to me about the Okanagan people. She said, you know, we have the same problems that white people have in terms of getting along. We fight just as much as anybody else does, but the big difference is I know that we're going to be living together for 500 years, and my great-grandchild might end up marrying your great-grandchild. And so we have to figure out how to get along. And that's part of the difficulty, is that a larger mass culture, you know, fine, I can rip somebody off because I can just go somewhere else and rip somebody else off again. It's much easier to avoid accountability, and that's true with the natural world, too. But if you just destroy a place and move on, you know, where is that accountability? And at the same time, it gives you a competitive advantage in terms of warfare, for example, that if you're cutting down trees to make war machines, you will have an advantage over another culture nearby that is not cutting down those trees to make war machines. And so I have, and then another problem with it all is that a culture, a religion, a cosmology, whatever we want to call it, a mythology, one of the things that they're supposed to do is to teach you how to live. And for something to teach us how to live sustainably, that means it must teach us how to live in place. Because one would live much differently here in the rainforest of what's now Northern California than one would live in the deserts of Arizona. So you have to have a different culture and a different sort of identity. You will be a different person in Arizona than you would be in Northern California.
Right.
And so there's, we could have an interesting talk about the benefits of species, identification. But in that conversation, we also need to include the importance of local identification.
Right. Well, that's what I mean by
also for divinity, because that's one of my problems with Christianity and Buddhism and all the major, quote, major religions, is that if a religion is transposable over space or over time, then it's not going to be teach you how to live in that particular place, because different things will be sacred in different places,
right,
and different things will be valued in terms of just using sacred, not in sort of a cosmic way, but in a, you know, what's valuable way, that you will have a different relationship to water in Arizona than you do here. And then one last thing about that, which is that another role of any religion, including science, is to help us engage with the divine or not, as the case may be. And if you have, you know, a religion that where it's a distant sky god, that's not going to teach you how to experience the divine and however you want to define divine that will experience the divine in this place here. That'll be really different. The stories, that's really what it comes down to, is the stories, I think, have to come from place.
Right. Derek's going to stay with us till 1 o'clock. From 1 to 2, I'm going to continue some of these themes, and I brought in a piece from Thomas Berry that I'm going to read from 1 to 2, Derek, to the audience, that speaks just to this. We're not going to take the time to do that right now. This mass culture is subhuman, and what we're looking for is to remember our humanity. And you recall the story that I think it's literal. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but that Mr. Zerzan wrote about the Pavlov's dogs, about conditioning and the nature of
and they forgot all the conditioning in a fire or something like that.
In an instant,
flood or something.
Yeah, yeah. That I mean, there's such. I mean, the Pavlov's dogs are the very epitome of conditioning, a conditioning behavior, and supposedly there was some sort of emergency in the lab and in the laboratory, and the dogs were. It was either a fire or a flood, and they were released from their cages, and instantly all their conditioning evaporated like so much smoke, and they reverted to their animal reality, their animality, their dogness. Just as we're going to hopefully revert to our humanity once we really begin to feel the nature of the catastrophe that we're involved in here.
Well, that's that's part of the hope, and that
I know you've written about hope, and
that's part of the whatever the word. That's hope, because that's out of our control, really, at that point.
Yeah.
And I think
it's there for us. I think it's a potential. I think it's inherent in who we are.
I think that there will be some of that. And in addition, years ago I was talking to Judith Herman, and Judith Herman was referencing a study by Peggy Reeves-Sandey about rape cross-culturally, and why are some cultures high-rape cultures and why are some cultures low-rape cultures. And what Peggy Reeves-Sandey found was that there are some predictors that are pretty much expected. You know, if it valorizes men and devalues women, you're going to have a higher rape. If it valorizes the military, you're going to have high rape. And a bunch of others that we would just expect. But there was one that was pretty surprising, in a sense, which was that if there was a history of severe ecological dislocation within the last 400 years, that would be a marker of a high rape, or a predictor of a high rape culture. And, okay, that's what Peggy Reeves-Sandey said. And what my interpretation of that is that when we aren't connected to a land, it takes us about 400 years to start reconnecting. And I think there can be a lot of that conditioning can disappear right away. There was when I lived in Spokane, there was this ice storm that knocked the electricity out for, gosh, like 2 weeks, and it was pretty cool how the neighborhoods came together, and you know, people that were all atomized and had never spoken with each other now are helping each other out, and that was all great. And that's on one side. And then on the other side, we also have, you know, what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you get these mass rapes when a society falls apart.
Right.
When patriarchal values are still, you know, open and valued, then that's one of the things we're going to see.
Right.
And so what I see, for what it's worth, which is not much actually, is there will be an increase in, though obviously as this culture breaks down, there will obviously be a decrease in certain forms of violence. For example, it will be much more difficult for corporations to kick subsistence farmers off their land when there's no longer international powers to kick them, you know, military force to kick them off from, you know, United States or whatever. When the landlords are no longer able to buy guns and ammunition from the United States or Israel or whomever, then it's going to be much harder to kick poor people off their land. That form of violence will, those forms of systematic violence, and then the violence against the natural world will also cut back. You won't have trawlers, you know, just vacuuming the oceans without oil. And on the other hand, there will be increased breakdown of society such that the, you know, the sort of organized rapes that we see in Democratic Republic of Congo, I think, are going to be quite predictable. And so with that same discussion of responsibility and accountability, I think that we need to prepare for that, too.
Right.
And there are ways for that particular one. Men can have their loyalty, can now state their loyalty to women, and can work with women in defense before that happens. And then what women can do is learn self-defense as well.
Right.
And, you know, it's like all the survivalists who are, you know, gathering food for, you know, the whole peak oil thing. It's not just gathering food. It's also protecting other parts of the land. It's protecting the land. It's protecting ourselves from other parts. Because the whole collapse will be, and the collapse is already nasty, especially from non-human perspective. That's how we started with A Dream from the Frog.
Right.
And the collapse will continue to be nasty on the way down because of exactly what you're talking about, because people are not going to give up the comforts or elegancies of this way of life without a fight.
Right.
They'll give up the sand without a fight, but they won't give up the comforts or elegancies of this way of life without a fight.
Right. Well, it's our responsibility. The behavior in the Democratic Republic of Congo is our responsibility. And we need to perform an intervention.
Right.
We need to perform an intervention in definitions of manhood. I mean, the definition
right.
of manhood has changed radically in the last 20 years.
Right.
It used to be protect the nest, protect the family, protect the home, and now the home is the whole earth community.
Right.
And this is what manhood is now become, is what it obliges those of us who would be real men and real women in this world at this time. This moment obliges us to intervene in all degenerate human behavior because we can no longer afford it. There's no tolerance policy for sociopathic behavior. And
what we need to get to. I totally agree.
Well, we haven't yet achieved, and I think what is crucial is a consummate articulation of who we are as humans, of our humanity, and of the challenge that we're facing here.
You know, I mean this as sincerely as I can say it, that that seems very, very
naive.
Important to you, and you have articulated a bunch of stuff that is really crucial just in this hour. And if I could encourage you, it would be to make that articulation yourself and to write that up.
Well, I you know, everyone, this is what everyone tells me, Derek, and I tell them you insist that I play it on the piano, but I happen to be a violinist. And what I've been asking people for several years now is to please download me, or please give me the opportunity to speak, and to whether it's in dialogue or in interview form. I find it to be a different medium than writing. I can write, but I want to speak it, and I want to be downloaded, because I've had the great good fortune to cross paths with any number of very powerful, brilliant human beings, I claim to have a certain understanding that has not yet found its way into the communal dialogue. But that's beside the point right now. But thank you, and you know, we're all working night and day because we're really racing against the clock here.
Right.
You know, if we have no loyalty for our family, to our family, then we could go in any number of directions from here. Just for a moment, Derek, if you will, we're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California. It's Monday, August 24th, 2009. It's about 12:48, and we have as our guest on the telephone, Derek Jensen, the prolific and potent writer and speaker and advocate for our human family, And you know, this might interest you. It might not. I'm sure you've this won't be the first time, but I've given your books to any number of people, and it's more than one have called me up and said, you know, this book made me broke me down, made me weep. I cried reading this book. And then on the other hand, I gave one of your books, The Culture of Make Believe. I gave it to and it's difficult material, you know that, but we're big boys and girls, and this is part of our obligation, our responsibility, to look things square in the face. And I gave Culture of Make Believe to a very, very prominent American Buddhist, activist Buddhist. And the book was returned to me, and this person informed me that the book that he or she could not read the book and would not read the book because he or she felt that it was really nothing more than just regurgitated bile. And I was so stunned by this. I mean, this is someone who is quite an accomplished and a remarkable person who does no end of good work in the world. And to be averse to engaging your work. And you know, I came back and I was shocked, and I inquired as to whether we might profit from having a conversation about the nature of bile, but we didn't go much further than that. You know, I was looking at Thought to Exist in the Wild last night, and for those who don't know it, this is a book about the subtitle is Awakening from the Nightmare of Zoos, and it's a gorgeous book about the nature of zoos, and it's written by Derek Jensen and with photographs by Karen Tweedy Holmes, and it's a heartbreaking book, and I was looking at it, and what I realized was we don't see what's right in front of us. I've gone to zoos my whole life. Oh, look, there's the giraffe, there's the elephant. And I've enjoyed zoos my whole life. And I never saw really what has been right before me all the time, that these others, whether they be animal or whether they be any form of life that's experienced as an other is also a subject. There's someone home there, just like you. And to look at these captives, these animals that are enslaved in zoos, is to break your heart. And what I'm saying here is that I, and by extension we, don't see things that are right, that are staring us right in the face.
Well, we're systematically trained not to, and that's the only way an abusive system can continue, is if we systematically deny the subjective existence of another. I mean, you couldn't rape someone if you allow that they have a subjective existence, and you couldn't exploit someone, and... What, you know, R.D. Lang wrote that the first rule of a dysfunctional family, or the three rules of a dysfunctional family, are rule A is don't. Rule A1 is rule A does not exist, and rule A2 is never discuss existence or non-existence rules A1 or A2. So you can't talk about what is directly in front of our faces. Mm-hmm. And if you do, then... You're violating that fundamental rule.
Right.
And the problem, a couple problems. One of them is, the editor I had for Language, Old and Words and Culture Make Believe, I was writing him some stuff, and I said, you know, the stuff I'm writing is really scaring me. And he wrote back and said, I dare you to scare me. Nothing could be scarier than this culture. So, I mean, obviously it's fine if a prominent American Buddhist or, you know, my next door neighbor, it's fine if they don't read or don't like my books. That's fine. You know, nobody has to read them all. and nobody has to read any of them for that matter. But at the same time, I would suggest that it's not that the book is simply full of bile. I would suggest that the reality we face is extremely ugly.
Right.
And it's like a doctor friend of mine always says, the first step toward cure is proper diagnosis.
Right.
And if we can't look at the situation that we're facing,
right,
then there is even less chance that we'll do anything about it.
Right.
And then the other thing, and this has to do with something I've gotten from a few American Buddhists over the years, is, you know, say, gosh, you know, you just don't have compassion. It's like, you know what? My compassion is for the victims and the survivors.
Mm.
And my compassion is not for a perp as such, a perpetrator as such. If the perpetrator wants to quit perpetrating, then we can talk about whether, if I have any compassion left over, then we can talk about whether I'll give some compassion to that former perp. But as long as a perpetrator is still perpetrating, then there is no, then actually having compassion for them at that point is enabling further destructive perpetrating behavior. That if I see someone victimizing someone else, it is my responsibility to attempt to stop that exploitation. And then once it's all done, then we can talk about whether we want to have restorative justice or retributive justice, whether we want to just, you know, knock the person in the head with a war club, or whether we want to, you know, sing them happy songs until they're a different person, you know, whatever. We can talk about that later, but the first and primary thing is you've got to stop the perpetration.
Right. I have a lot of problems with religions because they seem to put a brand name on aspects of our humanity that are inherent in our humanity before, I mean, you would think that there was no such thing as compassion before the Buddha was born, or there was no such, that compassion wasn't part of our repertoire. You know, if Buddhism didn't exist at all.
That's a wonderful point, and I've never thought of that before, but that's absolutely right. And that's true with Christianity. I mean, we acted with such, you know, Christian kindness.
Right.
And it's like, what? So kindness didn't exist before then?
Right. Without Christianity, there's no kindness?
Yeah. That's a great... You know, and science has done the same thing with knowledge. That, you know, science has gained a, you know, monopoly on knowledge, too. Sam Harris actually says that science can make a claim to all knowledge that we gain. All knowledge is then considered science. When I talk, as a whole other subject for another day, but when I attack science, so many people say, gosh, are you against knowledge? And, you know, it's like, no, you know, science is one very specific form of knowledge that has attempted to gain a monopoly on science. It makes me think of the whole Christian church thing about, what was the old line about, outside the church there is no salvation?
How obnoxious can you be?
Yeah. And the reason I say that is because, you know, then there's the implication, outside Buddhism there's no compassion, outside... outside science, there's no knowledge, et cetera, et cetera.
Big business.
Well, and it's all about enclosing. It goes back to enclosing the commons. You know, the compassion is the commons again.
Right. I've heard science described as the religion of the left brain.
Huh. That's good.
So where do we go from here, collectively?
Well, the first thing we need to do is... from my perspective, the first thing we need to do is shut down the industrial infrastructure.
Right.
Because it's the engine that's killing the planet. If you walked into your bathroom and you saw that the tub was overflowing and the water's flowing into the tub,
right,
what's the first thing you do? You turn off the tap. And right now, the burning of fossil fuels is killing the planet.
Right.
I mean, it's possible that global warming could turn the planet into Venus. And the only measure by which we'll be judged by those who come after is the health of the land base. And so the first thing we need to do is to use whatever means are necessary to stop that, because the people, once again, who come after are not going to care about whether we, you know, wrote books or did these really, you know, conducted really great interviews like you're doing, or they're not going to care about whether we were happy, not happy, not going to care about whether we voted Democrat, Republican, Green. They're not going to care about any of that stuff. What they're going to care about is whether they can breathe the air and drink the water.
Right. It's whether we succeeded or not.
Yeah. And they're going to care about whether they can eat the salmon and whether the salmon are returning to make healthy for us. And so what we need to do on a larger scale is shut down the industrial infrastructure. And what we need to do on the smaller scale, the first thing we need to do is, like all my American Indian friends say, that the first and most important thing we have to do is to decolonize our hearts and minds. And what that means is to recognize the culture for what it is, to recognize that technological progress is not progress. It's escalation, really. To recognize that we're living on stolen land, and to recognize that the comforts or elegancies of this way of life are based on misery and exploitation. Sorry if that's too much bile. And another thing we need to realize is that those in power are not invulnerable. There's this terrible, terrible, we can't fight back because we'll lose. Well, the thing is, if you're on the side of life, that's the side that's going to win. And we need to just align ourselves with it. And that's really crucial, because in the French Resistance in World War II, the single most important turning point in terms of gaining additional recruits for the French Resistance was when they realized the Germans could be beaten. And that's what we need to do. Is one of the first things we need to do is to demystify those in power. That's why the El Salvadorans, the Sandinistas, that's why the Sandinistas when they would kill a particularly nasty military officer who was committing atrocities against the peasants, they would leave his body in the town for everyone to see, so that the peasants could, I'm making this sound like peasants are, so that the people in the communities could realize that their oppressors were not invulnerable. He's just a man, just like anybody else.
That's right.
And one of the things we need to do is to demythologize. Not only is this culture killing the planet, not only is it not good, but it's also not one of the smartest things, one of the smartest things that the Christians ever did, the Judeo-Christians, is to make an omnipotent God who watches you when you're sleeping. He's just like a bad Santa Claus, you know? And he knows everything, and he's all-powerful. And that's the greatest method of social control you could ever get, is this patriarch who sees everything. That's a patriarchal wet dream.
The opticon.
Yep. So that's one of the things we need to do, is to recognize, well, I mean, MEND right now, the Movement for the Emancipation of the Niger Delta, is they've been able to reduce oil production extraction in Nigeria by 20%. And these are people who don't have, these are people who are, you know, starving to death, desperately poor people, and they've been able to put this together. And one of the reasons is because they have a lot of courage, and they have a lot of loyalty to their land and to their communities. And they have a courage that we can only dream about right now. But we need to get that courage. That's another thing we need to do, is we need to gain courage.
Right.
There are so many people, and I'm not talking, you know, when I say, we need to do all this, the big distinction is not between violence and nonviolence. The big distinction is between those people who do something and those people who do nothing. What we need to do is to do something. Find out what you love. Find out what your gifts are. Like you just said, you know, you're not going to write a book. That's great. People have said to me, gosh, Derek, you need to be an organizer. Stop writing and doing organizing. I hate organizing. I can't even organize my pens, you know, and I'm very much an introvert, and I'm a writer. I have that gift. And so people need to find what their gifts are and use them in the service of their land base, in the service of their communities. And we can all do that, and start small with just do, you know, one act a week. One act doesn't mean going out and monkey wrenching a log loader. What it means is whatever. I mean, start really small. I was doing this talk up in Olympia, Washington several years ago, and there was about, 500 or 600 people in the audience, and they're all going crazy, and it's like a rock concert. Yeah, let's bring down civilization. Yeah. And I stopped and I said, how many people here have ever filed a timber sale appeal? Maybe 5 or 10 people. How many people have ever worked at a battered women's shelter or on a rape crisis hotline? Maybe 10 women. How many people have done any indigenous solidarity work? You know, 3 or 4. I mean, people can write to political prisoners. There are political prisoners in the United States, and people can write to them. They're many of them are, I mean, they're still Black Panthers who are still in prison from, and they went in a long time ago, and they're old men who are prisoners. And there's plenty that people can do. They can do stream rehab work, they can pull out exotic species. You know, there's plenty of work to do, which, and then they can stop developers. I mean, there's so much work to be done, and they can find something and start doing it. And that's the thing. And they need to start getting some victories. We were able to stop a developer in this neighborhood. We won, kind of. He still cut some of the trees, but we were able to stop him. And that's great. And people need to start doing that.
And that includes taking the phone off the hook and turning the computer off and reading a book once in a while.
Well, I think that that's a necessary step, too. And the only hesitation I have on that is that how does that help the community? You know, that in addition, I agree with you that that's very important to do. And then in addition, we need to do something that helps the community out there.
Well, it's 1:05. Shall we hang it up for now?
Well, yeah, because I got to take my mom into town, speaking of communal responsibilities.
Okay. Thank you so much. Maybe we'll do another hour
Other time. Yeah, we should do that. That would be really fun.
Terrific. Thank you, Derek. I'll be in touch.
Okay, sounds great. Thanks. Bye.
Derek Jensen from his home in Northern California via the telephone. I'll take the phone off here. And you're listening to, it is 1:05, you're listening to KOWS 107.3 FM in Occidental, California.